A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on August 28, 1995, in the series The Human Story, Paradigms of Grace, entitled Joseph, Breaking the Cycle of Violence. The scripture readings are Genesis 37, verses 12 through 24, and chapter 45, verses 1 through 5, Romans 12, verses 9 through 21, and Matthew 5, verses 38 through 48. The texts for the sermon are Genesis 45, verse 4, Romans 12, verse 21, and Matthew 5, verses 44 and 48. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Emergence has been a key word in this summer series. Process that is emerging. The whole cosmic process, the whole human story emerging out of the slime pit, lured by the Spirit toward shalom. I set that model over against the more traditional model that is in the biblical tradition and in the Christian tradition, that idea of perfection and fall, from which there must ensue redemption. I see the redemptive process more as a continuous process from a beginning in the cosmic process, moving to a point of the evolving of the human person, who is then breathed into by the Spirit of God and lured upward, even as he is dragged always downward. Emergence. Well, you could say emergence as a mindless, meaningless process going nowhere. And there are many in our day that would say that. Or that emergence could be a process which is the consequence of one who said, "Let there be," and who patiently accompanies the process, moving it toward a transcendent purpose and goal. The whole idea of creation or evolution is not a question of God or not God. You can have God in the starkest creationism, and you can have God in a total evolutionary scheme of things. But how does one have God engaged with the process? So if I speak of emergence, I'm speaking about a cosmic process, billions of years, which has its source and its goal in God. And that's the image that we've been thinking about this summer, as we've gone back and revisited these old stories. We're in the fourth generation of the covenant family this morning. Joseph. You know the story of Joseph? Covers chapters 37 to 50 of Genesis. I couldn't possibly retell that whole story, but you remember Joseph was the favorite of Jacob, the favorite son, that caused, therefore, jealousy on the part of the brothers. And Joseph was a dreamer. Joseph had a dream. He told his dream It's one thing to have a dream, it's another thing to declare your dream. Maybe he was naive, maybe he was just insensitive, but anyway, he told his dream, and his dream was a dream that he would rule, that he would have dominion, that the family would bow to him, to Joseph. And so one day when his father sent his favorite son, whom he always kept at his side, kept home, out to his brothers to visit to see how things were, the brothers unleashed their jealousy and their hatred, and they decided to do away with him. Well, they ended up actually selling him into slavery, and then after a long, convoluted history, Joseph in Egypt, being not only a dreamer, but one who interprets dreams and interprets the dream of the Pharaoh, and comes to power in Egypt, and in a period of drought, actually, the brothers are sent by their father Jacob to Egypt to get grain, and with whom must they deal? None other than Joseph, although they don't recognize him, but he recognizes them. And then it is that Joseph is on the spot. Earlier on in the series, the question was raised in the story of Cain and Abel, what will you do with your anger, Cain? And now the question comes to Joseph. Joseph, now that you have come to power and you have your brothers literally bowing before you, what will you do, Joseph? That was the struggle in the heart of Joseph. What's going on here? What's the text telling us? What is this story about? I find it very helpful, the suggestion that the story was composed at the time of Solomon. Solomon was the king when Israel was at the apex of his power and his glory. David, the golden age, David's son Solomon, living in splendor and pomp and circumstance, and the culture of his day was a culture of power and confidence and competence and affluence. It is the kind of cultural situation not unlike our own. When a people come to power, when they gain a sense of great self-confidence, when they trust their own competence, and when they rely on their affluence, and God skitters off into the wings. It was an age, so to speak, of the eclipse of God. Probably not that the people doubted the reality of God, they simply doubted the relevance of God. Sound familiar? A time not like our own. And so the biblical writer, like the preacher at the tail end of the 20th century, is always trying to trick people to say, hey, you who are so confident and so competent in your own resources and capabilities, do you think there may be more to life than meets the eye? What is the place of faith in an age of power? And how need one trust when one has life pretty much at bay, managing very well? Thank you very much. The story of Joseph is the story about a dream. And Joseph's dream is the key to the interpretation of this story. As the biblical writer is suggesting that God may be hidden But God isn't out of business. Where do dreams come from? Who puts dreams in human hearts? Is there more to the cosmic process and the unfolding of the historical drama than meets the eye? Is there that uncanny presence? This was the suggestion, I believe, of the storyteller. I think the text this morning makes a claim. And the claim is that God is present in the human drama, indeed, in the whole emerging cosmic process. God, if invisible, is not without engagement and involvement in our lives. In the age of faith, when people swallowed everything whole, the church talked about predestination. Now there's a word for you. Some of you remember that awful word, predestination. At its worst, understood poorly, explained inadequately, what it came down to was the fact that everything's determined ahead of time, that the script is written, that we become nothing more than puppets on a string who are acting out that which is already determined. How we have strained in the past to say that predestination doesn't mean fatalism, but frankly, it was never very successful. And popularly, this is just the kind of philosophy that is expressed colloquially as whatever will be, will be. There's a kind of comfort in that. You don't have to think too much. You don't even have to worry too much. Whatever will be, will be. But in its faith explanation in past generations, it was that there is a predestinating will of God that is working itself out. Never did like it. There is a softer version of it that I've kind of liked. The providence of God. And Joseph's story is the classic location for the idea of the providence of God. The providence of God would simply assert that, without explaining too carefully, that God has a good end in mind, and that God present in the process is nudging it toward that good end. Paul said, if God be for us, who can be against us? Providence has given a great comfort to believing people down through the ages. Not providence in the sense that God becomes the divine lackey to every human whim. I mean, we speak popularly things that we don't really believe, I think. We say, wow, God was really with me there. Well, what about all the rest of the time? But in this claim of the text, there is a claim that there is more to life and history and the cosmos than meets the eye. We may be in a culture that is competent and confident. We know a great deal. We know about viruses and microbes. We know about weather systems. We know about economic laws. We know about all of the sociological laws that operate. We know, we can explain. We have come to where we pretty much know how things are, don't we? Well, Pharaoh knew how things were too in Egypt, which was the world's great civilization. And Pharaoh must have assumed in all of his people that Pharaoh held power. And yet, the text says, there was a dream operating. And there was a dreamer in the process. And the text is very careful never to suggest that the dream is some kind of divine intrusion. These people are real people. These people will and choose and act. And we have, again, in the Joseph story, all of the meanness and all of the manipulation and all of the bitter fruit that we've seen in these previous weeks and that we experience in our daily lives. Manipulation and meanness and bitter fruit. Terrible grief for Jacob, who loses his beloved son. Terrible suffering for Joseph because of the violence and hatred of his brothers. Awful guilt of the brothers as they realize what they have done and feel the world crashing in upon them. This is real stuff. They made their choices. They exercised their will. They acted. But the claim of the text is, uncannily, nevertheless, nonetheless, don't you see? Here's Joseph on the throne and his brothers are bowing before him. The dream comes true. Well, if that's the claim of the text, there's a call in the text too. And the call of the text is a call to join the dreamer in making the dream come true. God isn't very much present in all of that long Joseph story. You read it, God doesn't show up very often. But God shows up in that moving closing scene that we read. God shows up in retrospect. But even then, God might not have shown up, because there was a struggle going on in Joseph's heart. Joseph was no paragon of virtue. That's what we preachers have done with all these biblical characters over all the years. We've made them larger than life, put them up on a pedestal, put them out of reach as though they were different than we are who have clay feet. No, no different. Joseph saw his brothers coming, and Joseph had every natural instinct that we've all learned in our jungle survival. Joseph had every natural instinct to let them have theirs. He was harsh to them. He said, "You're spies." They said, "We are not." He said, "You're spies." They said, "We're not. We're just hungry." He said, "You're spies." "Do you have a father?" "Yes, we have a father." "Do you have a brother?" "Yes, we have a brother." "Well, next time when you come back, bring the brother so I'll know you're right." They said, "We can't bring our brother. Our father lost his beloved son, and now this youngest, he'll never let him go. If he doesn't come with you, just don't bother coming." I kind of like Joseph for that. He sort of got his bile out. You got to get your bile out. You got bile too. You can't deny it. You're just as ornery as the rest of the human race. Sometimes we're so saccharine sweet in the church, we deny that we have all of that raging feeling within. So they went home and he really set them up, if you read the story. They were scared to death. They said to Jacob, "Can't go back without Benjamin." He said, "You're not going back with Benjamin." They said, "We're not going back." But they got hungry again. Finally, Judah steps forward and says, "I will take responsibility." And Jacob relents. Benjamin comes. Now Joseph sees Benjamin, his brother, the brother of his mother, Rachel. And his heart melts. Another place in the scriptures where that same word is used, the only other place, is in Hosea 11, verse 8, where God says, "I'm going to give you up because of all your disobedience, O Israel." And then God says, "But how can I give you up? My heart yearns for you." That divine love that simply forces God to stick with us when there's not a reason in the world to stick with us. Joseph's heart yearns for his brother Benjamin. And he looks at his other brothers. Judah has made a moving appeal on behalf of Benjamin. Judah has put his own life on the line now. Obviously, something's happened to the brothers too. And Joseph is now at the moment of crisis. Finally, he can't hold it in anymore. He says to the Egyptians, "Clear out of here." He's alone with his brothers and he begins to weep. And he says, "I am Joseph, your brother." And they said, "Oh, that four-letter word." And he said, "Not to worry. Not to worry. Because there's been something else operative here that I didn't know and you didn't know. There's been a hidden presence. I've been an agent of a dream that wasn't of my own spinning." And Joseph let it go. He broke the cycle of violence. Instead of retaliation, he forgave. And there was reconciliation. And the dream of the grand dreamer received a great nudge forward, as it did when another Jew said, "You have heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." There was a day, incidentally, when an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was a step forward in the process. What it really meant was an eye for an eye, not a life for an eye. A tooth for a tooth, but you knock my tooth out, I can't then take your life. Let the penalty match the injury. There was a certain justice there. That was a step forward at some point in this long, torturous human process. But Jesus said, not an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who despitefully use you. Ah, Jesus. But he embodied it as well as taught it. For he said, as he was dying, over against those who were killing him, Father, forgive them. Because they're not really evil. They just don't know what they're doing. And thus, the later Joseph, Jesus, broke the cycle of violence. And the violent Paul, who is engaged by this risen Lord in vision, on his way, breathing out threatenings, ready to kill in the name of God for God's truth, is himself broken and can write words such as Romans 12, be not overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good. Only thus is the cycle broken. Only thus is the lure from above that laces the process through a dream ever finally to be realized in the shalom of God. But if that looks like a long way off, let me suggest this. Thus to live is to find life. To be transforming and to be transformed, really set free. That's the call of the text.